I'm Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana. Grateful to be here for a second week of Bible studies on love and the unity of love. Especially grateful to be here on this gorgeous morning, which I say is gorgeous because I have word that back home it is headed toward 100 degrees for the next several days in a row. I am grateful to be at Holden instead of Indiana. A couple of footnotes. Several people have asked since yesterday if those of you who were here yesterday heard me talk rehearse Midrash, some Midrashic material, and people wondered, what is that? Where does that come from? It's not in the Bible, is it? And the answer is no. It is one of the several kinds of responses to the scriptures in Jewish culture. The word Midrash comes from the Hebrew verb darash, which means to make an inquiry, to dive into something and search out something somewhere. So a midrash is an inquiry into some piece of the scripture, usually the Torah, but it can also be about the prophets, as was the one on Jeremiah yesterday. It is sometimes merely a brief commentary, like a note, that tries to explain something, and it usually probes some mystery that the story leaves. Like some of the most obvious examples are, where did Cain's wife come from? We suddenly seem to be in a populated world, and we haven't been told about these other people. So people write Midrash, or have written Midrashic literature over the centuries, to go after those gaps, those questions, those mysteries. And they are all over the place. There's no one great collection of the Midrash. They're all over there, still being written. There was an interesting collection of Midrash produced just in the last couple decades by a rabbi named Mark Gelman. Some of you may know the book, Does God Have a Big Toe? The book of modern Midrash, probing into questions. So that's what kind of literature Midrash is. Secondly, another footnote, which is in a way a kind of a lead-in to today's topic. I had never done this Rachel material that I was doing yesterday, while also very consciously, along with another bunch of people, been thinking about Islam. And it dawned on me for the first time the oddity, and it probably shouldn't have been the first time, but the character at the end of Moby Dick, Ishmael, who is the child from whom in the Abrahamic traditions Islam traces its lineage, as opposed to Isaac, from which Judaism traces its lineage, Ishmael is saved not only by a coffin, but by a ship named for a mother of the people of Isaac, Israel. And so the one family takes in the other family in the aftermath of what wicked Ahab perpetrated. And out of the destruction of that story comes this, at least momentary, unity of these two families. I don't know Melville well enough to know what Melville was thinking. And I can't get online up here and find out what literary scholars think. I I did just for a moment go up there and see what is most immediately available, only to discover that everything that's obvious is on Cliff Notes and what's that other one? Save My Grade or something like that. But of course you have to pay. But anyway. So when I go home, I will examine this.
Right?
Yeah.
I know Melville served on a whaling ship, and he had opportunity to meet people who were Muslim and also who were Jewish. So he would have known people in both of both religions.
And I suspect that there is some meaning to this, and that it, and given Melville's understanding of scripture, and his learning, I'm sure that there's something there, but I don't know exactly what he intended. Yeah. I'm not going to pursue that today.
It does fit under the category of Midrash.
Pardon me?
It does fit under the category of Midrash.
Yeah. It is a Midrash. So the kiosk says we're going to talk about Jacob wrestling with the angel today. But that's going to be the middle of what we do. There's going to be something that sets the context of that in the scriptures first, and then I have a way to take an even later scripture and put us into this same story. So where we're actually going to start today, I mean, I'll remind you first of all that Jacob, who's the center story today, is a family member in a story that I read on the first day of this week, where there's this tangled love. Esau, his brother, was loved by Isaac. Jacob was loved by Rebekah. And these two loves collided as Rebekah overrode the customs and the laws and finagled her way into having her beloved child receive the blessings that really belonged to the older child, the one that Isaac loved. And so for some reasons, at least partly out of his own control, Jacob is a family member caught up in dysfunctional loving. But I think that the biblical context for the story of Jacob wrestling with the night stranger, which will be a centerpiece today, is all the way back in Genesis 4. And so we're going to start today with a story of two different brothers than the ones in the Jacob and Esau story. But oddly enough, it is another story of favoritism, and favoritism that causes trouble. The story of Cain and Abel. Genesis 4. Now the man knew his wife, Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, this is the NRSV. I have produced a man with the help of the Lord. The name Cain is from a verb that means acquire or to acquire. So I've acquired a man with the help of the Lord. Next, she bore his brother Abel, we say. Abel in Hebrew means a mist that quickly disappears. And that's the story of Abel's life. He is born to disappear, the way the story turns out, at least. Now, if you've ever seen any old movies, you know from the next sentence, we're headed for big trouble. Now, Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain was a tiller of the ground. Two cultures that don't mix, because one values open range and the other builds fences. And there the twain shall get along. In the course of time, we not only have that problem, But Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. Cain invents religion. He starts making offerings. And little brother Abel sees that and says, interesting. So he brought of the firstlings of his flock, their fat portions. So he made offerings too. And much is made of the fact that we get a description of the kind and the order of things that Abel offered, but we're not told that anything Cain offered was not the first fruits, or that there was anything wrong with it. But for inexplicable reasons, the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. How can you tell if God has regard for your offering? And the verb here, to have regard, is the verb that's used all over the Hebrew Bible for when God finally comes through with fulfilling a promise, just for example.
So it's if your crops grow or you have more sheep.
Pardon?
It would be, if for Cain, it would be if he had great crops and good weather. And
okay.
For people, it would be lots of baby lambs and...
I think that's exactly what it is. The text doesn't come out and say that directly. When I was a child, the Sunday school lessons that we received in church showed two young men making burnt offerings on two altars that were right next to each other, and the smoke of one was going straight up into heaven and the smoke of the other was being blown away. As though somehow it was very literally the smoke. But no, what this is about is Abel's religion appears to be working. He's getting what he wants for making offerings, which is God's favor and blessing, abundance. And it's not working as well for Cain. And so Cain does what people do when your brother is doing better than you are. He gets angry. So God comes around and says, what's the matter with your face? Why has your countenance fallen? He doesn't leave time for Cain to answer. God knows very well what's going on and says, if you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. Lots has been written about this, but in short, God just seems to say, look, this is how it is. This is a test. How are you going to handle this? Keep on keeping on. Do the best you can. And all will be well. You start trying to do something untoward here, there's going to be big trouble. So just keep at it. Do you like being told that when it's you? No, because it still looks unfair. Mm-hmm. I invented religion. He's a copycat. And you're giving him everything, and I'm just scraping by. What's the deal? Well, Cain, I mean, who is Who is Cain's nemesis? It's not Abel. Cain's nemesis is God.
Right.
But he can't wring God's neck. So he does the next best thing. I'll show you God. You got your little pet here? I will fix your pet and see how you like that. So Cain said to his brother Abel, let's go out in the field. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. And then the Lord says to Cain, I always ask my students how they're going to cast, how they would cast Genesis 1 and then later Genesis 2, 3, and 4. And of course, God is off stage and speaks like James Earl Jones in Genesis 1. But in Genesis 2 and 3 and 4, this God who operates by trial and error and walks around playing dumb, like he's going to do in just a second here when I continue. I always picture, and this shows my age, I always picture Peter Falk as Columbo. Pulling up in that wreck of a car, wearing a wrinkled trench coat, holding a cigar, and says, now, Cain, where is your brother? I haven't seen your brother lately. Where is he? You seen him? Tell me this again. And Cain says, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? And this verb for keeping is all over the place in the earlier portions of this story. The verb for keeping is the thing that the human beings are charged with doing. This is what the human family's job is, to till the earth and to keep it. And the verb is shamar, which means to guard, watch over, protect, keep.
Is that stewardship too?
Pardon me?
Is that stewardship?
Yeah, that's stewardship in our language. So Cain is playing dumb too. I don't know. I know that we're supposed to till the earth and keep it, but we're supposed to keep brothers too. Is that in the job description? Now the Lord says, what have you done? Listen, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. The word for blood is dam, and the word for the ground is adama. And you don't put the dam into the adama. That's what I do, if anybody does it, not you. You put your brother's blood into the ground. So now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it will no longer yield to you its strength. You will be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. So God responds by cursing Cain's relationship to the ground that gave him his living. God does not curse Cain, just like God did not curse the man and woman in the preceding story. God curses everything else. Curses the serpent, makes difficult their experience, makes the ground to grow thorns and thistles instead of what you really want it to grow. So God sort of invents Murphy's Law. Everything that can go wrong will. But now, the earth will no longer give to Cain what he wants and needs, so he will be a wanderer and a fugitive. Cain says, that's more than I can bear. That's more punishment than anyone can handle. You've driven me from the soil. I shall be hidden from your face, a fugitive and a wanderer. Anybody who meets me will kill me. So again, like, who's that? Mom and Dad? So we need Midrash here, but we're not going to do that. No, says God. Here's the deal. Anybody who kills Cain will suffer sevenfold vengeance from God. So the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who came upon him would kill him. So Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. And you can read the rest east of Eden, in the great novel. There's a familiar pattern here to this story that is in every story from Genesis 2 to Genesis 11. Just as in Genesis 3, there's a violation of the order that God had created, including the prohibition against eating that one tree in the middle of the garden. This time it's murder, not merely stealing vegetables. And God comes and discovers it, walked around in the cool of that day, this time comes to pay a little visit to Cain, and discovers in paying a visit exactly what has happened, responds to what has happened with a curse, but does something to keep the show on the road. A provisional solution to what has been unleashed in the earth. In Genesis 3, it's shame. And God makes clothing. In Genesis 4, we have unleashed the desire for vengeance now, and your killing begets killing. And God says, no, that belongs to me. I'm putting a mark on this guy. You can't kill murderers. You can't kill murderers. Later on, violence will overtake the earth in Genesis 6 and following, and God will respond, will come and check it out, decide this time to respond with total washing away of everything, provisional solution being saving one family in hopes of starting over. And it doesn't work. Even saving one good family, we end up immediately with nakedness and shame and drunkenness and then violence. And so God admits at the end of Genesis 8, this doesn't work. You can do all the punishing and cursing you want, and it doesn't help a lick. All the violence doesn't solve anything. So God hangs up God's bow, and we don't get what the next plan is until later. I did some of this yesterday, I'm repeating now. And then comes the Tower of Babel story, in which people are going to storm the heavens and take over. God comes down, takes a look at this, and says, this is only the beginning. If these people get going with this monoculture, and so God, it's ambiguous whether the multiplication of languages and the confusion that's generated among humankind is a blessing or a curse. Because they can't understand each other, and that event throws humankind into the state that we know, which is a whole lot of cultures that can't understand or live with each other, and so they all split up and they go their separate ways, and they don't necessarily like each other that much, as the Smothers Brothers famously saying. the French hate the Germans and the German hate the Dutch, and I don't like anybody very much. But there's no provisional solution at the end of that until we get God at Genesis 12 saying, you, Abram, Sarah, you will be my agents of blessing in all the, for all the families of the earth. I've tried curse long enough. Now we're going to do blessing. It's my last hope. And if it fails, all is lost. So I always, when I lecture to college students about this, I say that this story, Genesis 1 to 12, is really a story about who God's people are, namely God's last hope for the world. Because if blessing fails, curse is all that's left. Another flood. But then, of course, we have to ask the question, in what way can a people be a blessing to all the families of the earth? And the way I read the rest of Genesis, we, I mean, there are many ways in which the chosen people become a blessing, although sometimes Abram and Sarah become a problem to the neighbors. But there are several stories which I think turn out to be stories of blessing, which are antidotes to the stories of curse from the beginning section of the Bible. By the way, the word blessing is comes from the word for knee. Barak is the word for bless. Baruch is blessed, as in Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Baruch Atah Melech Haolam. But it all comes from Berek, which means knee. Berek, knee. A blessing is what you get when you are on your knees. And whoever is going to bless you can give you anything. And you will receive it because you're not going to move too fast on your knees to get out of the way. You're going to receive what someone gives you when you are in the posture of kneeling. The interesting thing to me, theologically, is that God deigns to let us bless God. God kneels before us and lets us sing. And God willingly receives what we offer. That's pretty amazing. But I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on that right at the moment, because I want to move to the story that, as I see it, is the blessing of antidote to the story of Cain and Abel and the reasons for the murder. I want to say one more thing about Cain and Abel before before we move on. It's not exactly Midrash, but it's close to it. Elie Wiesel has written a number of books about these ancient biblical characters, and I looked for the one that I have back home called The Messengers of God in the library here. We don't have that one, but I want to tell you a little detail from the story of Cain and Abel from Elie Wiesel's perspective, because it's we're going to need this for what follows. Elie Wiesel talks about the shortcomings of Cain and the things that he didn't do that he might have done and so forth and so forth. But Elie Wiesel says Abel bears some responsibility for what happened too. And here's why. And as best I remember the sentence in Wiesel's Messengers of God in the chapter on Cain and Abel, it goes like this. When someone suffers, and it is not you, even if that suffering has somehow been imposed by your common God, your job as a human being is to stand with your brother or sister and not with God, and join your brother or sister in confronting the God who has given you suffering. And Abel didn't do that, or at least there's no evidence. So that's where we belong. When your brother or sister suffers, and it is not you, your place is not siding with God and defending God. Your place is with your brother or sister who suffers, even if it takes the two of you into confrontation with God, so that you stand before God together. All right, now, Genesis 32. Two brothers with a long history of the same kind of stuff that must have gone on between Cain and Abel. Twins born to Rebecca. And one of them born first with his brother's hand grasping his heel, trying to pull him back so that he might reverse the birth order and get the blessing of the firstborn, which was a really big deal in the ancient culture. The firstborn got the double share, and the rest split what was left. So Jacob, Esau's name means red or ruddy. Jacob's name, Yaakov, means he'll try to pull you down. He'll try to supplant you. He will get the best of you. Which turns out to be the story of Jacob's early life. With the help of his mother, he gets the blessing. With the help of his pottage, he gets yet another kind of blessing from his hungry brother. And I think there's a kind of an ethnic joke there. How dumb is an Edomite? Well, dumb enough to give away everything for a bowl of soup. Honestly, I do think there's ethnic humor of this kind woven into these stories. So Jacob gets the best of his brother, and with the help of his mother and his own cunning, he reverses the birth order, as he had tried to do in the moment of birth. But he has to flee for his life because his brother has now threatened to kill him. And now in Genesis 32, he has become an exceedingly wealthy person living in the territory of Laban, his father-in-law. And he has done all sorts of crazy things in order to make himself incredibly wealthy. And now he's on his way back. He's decided he will go back to the land of his birth and his mother and father and brother, but his brother is still back there, and he knows very well his brother is probably still angry. And so, it's a wonderful bunch of stories. Among other things, he sneaks out of town. He's afraid to tell Laban he's leaving, and so Laban tracks him down, and they have this big confrontation. That's very fun stuff, and it could be a whole session, perhaps. But what he's really worried about is that when he gets back home, Esau might kill him. So that he sets up this elaborate process of giving gifts, sending gifts ahead to soften up. And literally, the word appease, the Hebrew word for appease, he tries to appease Esau. In case Esau is not angry enough to ignore every sign of generosity, he sends a huge amount of stuff ahead to Esau and says, they say more to come. And then the night before he is to confront his brother, we read this. Genesis 32, verses 22 and following. The same night he got up and took his two wives, his two maids, and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and likewise everything that he had, and Jacob was left alone. I've always kind of wondered if that isn't a strange act of cowardice, as though he, because I can't really quite understand the spacing, but to send everybody else ahead and you linger back. And so while everybody else has been put into the risky territory, you're still back thinking and wondering, how's this going to go? Jacob was left alone and a man. Eesh. Totally nondescript term. Wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he struck him on the hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. So that's a... I don't know whether that's cheating. So whoever Jacob is wrestling with is playing some of Jacob's own games and gives him an injury deliberately so that he can't fight as well. And the man then says, let me go, for the day is breaking. But Jacob said, I'm not letting you go until you bless me. So he said, what's your name? And he said, Yaakov. And then the man said, you shall no longer be called Yaakov, but you shall be Israel, for you have struggled, fought with God and humankind, and you have prevailed. You're still here. You've survived. You've even gotten the best of people. So Jacob asked him again, please tell me your name. The stranger says, why is it that you ask my name? And then he blessed him, but no content given to the blessing for us to read. So Jacob called the place Peniel, for he said, I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved. So Jacob does a little theology here. Like Hagar did back in the wilderness in chapter 16, she has a meeting with God out in the wilderness, and God saves her from her and her child from death, and Hagar does the first theology in the Bible. She gives God a name. Oh, I see now who you are, God. Jacob does the same thing. I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved. The sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites don't eat the thigh muscle that's on the hip socket of the animals that they eat, because God had, or the stranger had struck Jacob on the hip socket at the thigh muscle. Well, I don't think we know what this story means until we see what happens next. are many mysteries that we're not going to take time or don't have the time to delve into, but this much is very clear and very interesting. Now Jacob looked up and saw Esau coming and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids, and he put the maids with their children in front, and Leah with her children, and Rachel and Joseph last of all, and he himself went on ahead of them. So at least now he's leading the procession. Bowing himself to the ground 7 times until he came to his brother, Esau ran to meet him. And the expression in Hebrew to run to meet someone is the very same expression that you use when armies engage. Oh. Lecrae. So for the first moment of this sentence, you don't know what kind of engagement this is. This could be Pickett's charge. And embraced him. And fell on his neck and kissed him and wept. When Esau looked up and saw the women and children, he said, "What's all? Who are all these people?" Jacob says, "The children God has graciously given to me, your servant." So then all the family comes and they meet everybody and share names. And Esau said, "What do you mean by all this company?" And Jacob said, "To find favor with you, my lord." And the Midrash knock Jacob mercilessly for calling Esau his lord. And so that there's no kindness toward Esau in the Midrashic tradition, but that's irrelevant. Esau said, "I've already got a plenty of stuff. You don't need to give me any more. Keep what you have for yourself." Jacob says, "No, please, if I find favor with you, accept my gift." And here's the key line. "For truly to see your face is like seeing the face of God, since you have received me with such favor." And then verse 12. So Esau finally accepts the gifts, and then Esau said, "Let us journey on our way, and I will go alongside you." And the two of them are reconciled. And Jacob sees in his brother, whom he desperately feared, a face of God. So here's what I think. I think this is a way of saying, you may think that your nemesis in life is your brother or whoever else you have issues with, who you have economic tension with, and all sorts of grudges from the old days. But your real struggle in life is with God. And if you wrestle God to a draw and come away limping, you will be able to see in your brother not an enemy, but you will see God. See God's face in your brother or sister or neighbor or rival or whoever. I think this is a blessing. If only Cain had known this, if he had fully grasped that his enemy was not his brother and that you could solve this by killing your brother, but that his nemesis was God, and maybe even with the help of his brother, stood before God and said, "What the hell, God? What is going on?" And the two of them together had it out. They could find God and relating to God together, looking each other in the face and seeing not an enemy, but seeing a way to be with God. Does that make sense? So, Israel, a people who struggle with God, become a people among all the families of the earth who teach us this, about how to wrestle faithfully with God instead of having to kill our brothers and sisters. Because that's where our biggest difficulty in life is, with God, not each other. Unfortunately, Esau and Jacob did not stay reconciled. Esau and Israel. Maybe they did, but Esau is the father of the Edomites, and Yaakov Israel, the father of the Israelites and the Jews, the Judeans. And we all know the history of the Israelites and the Edomites. We got one whole book of scripture that is nothing but one long damning curse against the Edomites, the book of Obadiah, because we hate the Edomites. They are our enemy, and we despise them, and we call down God's hatred on them too. So the tradition has moments when its best theology didn't work. And so many people have died. And Jews by the hundreds of thousands were martyred by the Edomites and by others like them. So that by the time of the writing of the Christian scriptures, there were apocalyptic kinds of Jewish writing that began to say that somehow or another God would find a way to redeem the lives of all those martyrs and collect all that blood from the ground that got poured into the ground and give it back to God so that those lives could be restored to God. And the rabbis said, how shall this be done? How will God get all that blood back that was poured into the earth? And the answer is, who best to go collect all that blood than the first martyr ever killed in the name of religion? Abel, whose full name was Avel ben Adam, or in English, son of man. And so it was taught that God would send Abel, the son of man, son of Adam, ben Adam, back to collect the blood of all the martyrs and take it to God, so that those lives, the lives of the martyrs, would be redeemed. And that figure, Ben Adam, son of man, shows up in our scriptures, and shows up in one very remarkable place where we can actually see precisely who he is. And that is in Matthew 25, verses 31 and following. The great parable of the judgment, which you know very well. When Ben-Adam comes in his glory and all his angels with him. He will sit on the throne of his glory, and all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate people from one another as shepherds separate sheep from goats. Put the sheep at his right and the goats at his left. And the king will say to those at his right hand, come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. Naked, and you gave me clothing. Sick, and you took care of me. In prison, and you visited me. And the righteous say, when was that? When did we see you? We really saw you? Well, yeah. I am the little brother. I am the least of the brothers and sisters. And when everything you do for the least of the brothers and sisters, if you knew who you're looking at me. That's my face, you see, if you treat me with kindness. Whose face you see, whether it's God's face or your neighbor's face, it gets all mixed up in these stories when you do or don't give kindness. And then, of course, we have the alternative. Then there's the people who did not. It's hard to imagine, but there are some who not even once visited someone in prison, or gave drink to the thirsty, or food to the hungry, or visited the sick. And so they go off into eternal. Matthew loves these images at the end of parables. They go off into the weeping and gnashing of teeth and into the great fire. So, if you know who you're looking at, when you get into something with your little brother, when you come upon the disadvantaged, when you come upon those who are in prison, and then maybe they deserve being in prison, we don't know, but your job, if somebody is in prison, is not to stand with the authorities, but to stand, even if it's God, to stand with the prisoner and say, together, we confront the world and God and whatever authorities run the world. I once had a crazy experience when I was trying to get ready to preach on this text on Christ the King Sunday. It comes up every third year in the Cycle A lectionary. And this is many years ago now, but I think it is one of the very few moments in my life where I have something that approximates revelation. I don't know why I suddenly thought this, but I knew this person in town, in my town, whose name happened to be Esther. She was the Mother Teresa of my town. And whenever anybody was sick, she showed up. Whenever anybody got in trouble, she showed up. Whenever anybody needed anything, she showed up. And she never asked, did these people deserve to be helped? If somebody needed help, she just went there and did it. And for some reason, I asked myself, what would Esther say if she was lined up there with the sheep getting her reward and then had to watch those others be marched off into the great perdition? What would she say? And I could not imagine her rejoicing, because those were probably the people she'd been ministering to And she could still see the face of the little brother in them even then. And so I did a little bit of midrash. And I asked, what would those people say? What would the Esthers of the world say? And I imagined they would say, wait, son of man, you can't do that. Give us one more chance. Let us go over there. But of course, this is a story of time having run out. And we only get so much space and time, we human beings, in which to be with our little brothers and sisters. And so the Son of Man has to say, sorry, you can't go. Time has run out. But the sheep aren't finished. Then they say, well, if you won't let us go, then you go. And then what's the Son of Man supposed to say? Because he taught them to talk like that. So then he has to go. One more time. After them. And we confess that he did this every time we say our creed. And we say, he descended to hell. And we flesh that out with the words of 1 Peter 3 and talk about how this one went and burst into the prison where the flood generation wiped out for the sins of the world, languished. And he said, what does he say when he gets there? When he goes to preach to the spirits in prison. By the way, he is visiting prison. Mm-hmm. I think he says what he always says. Come with me. We're going up to Jerusalem. And of course, we're going to die there. But that's not the end. That's my midrash. So, thank you.